Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. From 1950 to 1954, Senator Joe McCarthy destroyed many careers and even lives, whipping the nation into a frenzy of paranoia, accusations, loyalty oaths, and terror. We still use the term McCarthyism to stand for outrageous charges of guilt by association and a weapon of polarizing slander. Larry Tye has written a biography titled Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Welcome. I said, welcome back.
Great to be with you. Good to be back.
The very first words in the preface are, this is a book about America's love affair with bullies. So he certainly wasn't the first and not the last.
He wasn't. What he was the archetype. And he built on all the legacy of demagogues before him, people like Theodore Bilbo and Huey Long. And he became the role model for everybody who came afterwards, from David Duke and George Wallace to contemporary demagogues.
You write, now that we at last have access to the full sweep of the records on Joe McCarthy's transgressions, we can see that his rise and reign also go a long way toward explaining the astonishing ascension of President Donald J. Trump. While some seek comfort in the belief that Trump's election was an aberration, the truth is that he is the latest in a bipartisan queue of fanatics and hate peddlers who have tapped into America's deepest insecurities.
So I love to hear you read that, and I think that it is traumatic to be experiencing this, and yet there is good news built in that story, that every demagogue in American history, while many have reigned for longer than we'd like to have seen them, every one of them has spelled their own undoing, and the lesson is, given enough rope, bullies do themselves in.
Now, fair to say, most people would say Senator McCarthy was an evil man, but to some, he was absolutely charming.
To Ethel Kennedy, he was absolutely charming. Ethel got to know him when her husband, Bobby, went to work for Joe McCarthy as his first real job after graduating from law school. And Ethel said, when I was interviewing her for a previous book, a biography on Bobby Kennedy, that Joe McCarthy may have been a monster to much of America, but to her, McCarthy was an absolute delight. And I was so intrigued by that, by this iconic liberal family, Bobby and Ethel Kennedy, being charmed by Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, and that's where you got the idea for this book, isn't it?
That is where I got the idea for this book. I thought there has to be a reason why Joe McCarthy was elected and reelected in Wisconsin, and why in the early 1950s he was the second most popular politician in America. Ethel Kennedy gave me an up-close view of that, and I wanted to see the full story, the story of the villain I had grown up knowing, and the story of this more charming character who managed for four long years to captivate the country.
So you got that great interview with Ethel Kennedy, but you also got a new insight in this book from McCarthy's daughter. She gave you exclusive access to her father's personal and professional papers. So why you? Why now?
So I'd like to tell you that I was the most charming guy out there and that 60 years of biographers that the family had said no to, that they couldn't resist me. Honestly, I have no idea why, whether it was an alignment of the stars, whether it was the fact that she was getting older, the daughter, and wanted to see something done with the papers while she was still around to control them, or whether it was just a sense of my having been more of a pest than anybody else. I one day got an email from the archivist at Marquette University, McCarthy's alma mater, where Joe's widow had left his papers 60 years ago, and she said two things. One is, you have access, and the other is, the day you stop looking at them, they go under lock and key again. So thousands of pages of his personal and professional papers, and after that, I was shocked one day going for an early morning walk in Catuit to find at the head of our driveway an enormous brown delivery box from UPS, and that had in it all of McCarthy's medical records from Bethesda Naval Hospital. On top of that, there were all of his military records. So medical, personal, professional, military, and the last thing was 9,000 pages of transcripts of the closed-door hearings that McCarthy had held when he was a senator, and that made up two-thirds of the hearings that he held. People hadn't reviewed those transcripts, and the idea that after 50 years those were finally out there for me to look at meant that if I couldn't write a good book with all of that, shame on me.
And there's a lot of stuff in here that I don't think anybody, like you said, knew before. And interesting that when the medical records from the Bethesda Naval Hospital that show McCarthy did not die from acute hepatitis, as we were told, but from withdrawal and the DTs, and, you know, makes you wonder how the doctors could miss that, or did they, right?
So it makes you wonder whether they were trying to spare the family of the embarrassment that he died from being a really serious alcoholic, and came up with the much more diplomatic and white bread explanation of acute hepatitis. And it makes you wonder why all the journalists back then bought that and why they didn't dig deeper. And it makes me feel sad, despite all of the bad things McCarthy had done, from the moment at the end of 1954 when his Senate colleagues condemned him to 3 years later when he died, he lived a really tragic life. And those records from Bethesda Naval Hospital document in stunning detail his deterioration. And at the end, they had somebody sitting by his bedside for the last several days of his life, the recording his rantings, recording all these doctors who visited him with depressing sense of this guy who was fading. And there will probably never be anybody again who has that kind of a documented record. And the idea that it was finally made public, again, gave me an opportunity to try to tell a story about what really happened rather than the story that history had given us.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of documents you're talking about. That's a lot of stuff to sift through, a lot of research. You see, and I know it's taken a few years, but you seem to have done this in a short time.
So for journalists like you and me, Mindy, 2.5-3 years seems like an endless amount of time to work on a story. For authors and historians, that's not a whole lot of time. The good news was that I had a blast doing it, even though he was not exactly the kind of character you'd want to spend 2 years of your life living with. He was so fascinating, and I was studying his life story at a moment where, reading the daily newspapers, I sometimes had a difficult time remembering whether I was reading about what happened in the 1950s or reading about contemporary events. But his life helped me understand what we're living through now in a way that spending every day and working intently to get it done in 2 years was the difficult process. It was truly a joy.
Mm. All right, so let's talk about the young Joe McCarthy. Smart, hardworking, and entrepreneurial. Tell us about his younger years.
So he was enough of an entrepreneur that he was raised on a very modest farm outside of Appleton, Wisconsin, and taking a small loan from an uncle, he turned himself into a chicken tycoon, having thousands of hens, a chicken tycoon within the course of about a year. And he was so successful as an entrepreneur that he put off going to high school. When his chicken empire fell victim to a virus, he became a tycoon in the retail sales business. He went to work for a store called Cashway, and they had stores all over the state, and he ran the most successful one. And finally, at about the age of 20, he decided it was time to go back and get a high school education, and he managed to do 4 years in exactly 1 year in a way that nobody had ever done and probably nobody has since there. And it suggested that this was a guy who could make just about anything that he wanted to happen.
Yeah, he was very determined, wasn't he? And he became a lawyer. He went to college, became a lawyer, and then a judge. That, I think, was a bit surprising to me. What little I knew about Joe McCarthy before reading your book, judge is not what I expected at all.
No, but tell us about that. The image of the fair-minded judge that you like to think of. He did it by partly playing on his record as a World War II hero for the Marines in the South Pacific. he took that record, which was real, he embellished the heck out of that record, and he got himself elected to a series of offices. But as you say, starting out as a judge, he was out using his judicial office to politic as much as he was to decide cases. And he was nothing if not ambitious and ruthless in seeing his ambitions through.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about his military career. You know, we talked about embellishing that, but there was a while there where, you know, he was pretty much branded a fraud for claiming to be a war hero, but there was some truth to what he said about his military experience.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the things that was in those files at Marquette University was his diaries from his time in the South Pacific. And those showed in real time in terms of what he wrote, with confirmation letters from all of his comrades in arms in that era, that he was in fact the war hero that he had suggested, and that the medals he earned while he was there were ones he deserved. And the truth was that his official assignment was as a land-based intelligence officer, but he volunteered for missions as a tail gunner, flying against military etiquette, against the rules of what he was supposed to be doing, taking huge risk being up there under enemy fire as a tail gunner in a war zone in the South Pacific. And he did all of that in a way that deserved to, that he deserved to be a war hero, but he also had such a reputation for embellishing, if not lying, that it showed if you lie often enough, people are going to doubt when you're telling the truth, and that's what happened to his military record. The notion of Tail Gunner Joe, which he started as his campaign slogan, became a caricature to the point where CBS News did a nationwide broadcast of a documentary calling him Tail Gunner Joe as a way of making fun of him.
Mm. Now, when he first ran for office, he did not want to give up his seat on the bench, and then these questions of conflict of interest were raised.
Right. So in fairness to him, he could have given up his seat on the bench and gotten a huge award in terms of his popular image, and in terms of getting accolades from the governor and other judges for being brave enough to go into the Marines, signing up on his own, and giving up this judicial office. But he knew that the more important thing to him was having an office that would kickstart his next campaign. So at a time when the judiciary was hard-pressed to hear all the cases that it did, the seat went empty. Other judges had to pick up the workload, and Joe McCarthy violated every edict that ever came down from the Marine Corps and other elements of the armed services, saying, while you're serving us, you won't be running for office. And he ran for office from the South Pacific. He had huge banners saying McCarthy for senator on everything from his tent to all of the military vehicles that he could get access to. And it was classic Joe McCarthy, partly doing some legitimately heroic things and partly embellishing the heck out of it and ignoring every rule that applied to everybody else who was serving in the armed services.
And this is about the time, too, where, you know, we have these questions of conflict of interest, and he gets a century later, instead of disbarring, gave him that conviction that he was above the law.
Yes, he always had a sense that he was above the law, and he had a sense that the only people that it was suckers who listened to rules, that Joe McCarthy felt that what he was doing was in a public service as well as his personal service, and he felt that anybody who paid attention to legalities or to regulations was somebody that wasn't Joe McCarthy. And the idea that a judge and a lawyer thought that way was relatively outrageous.
Yeah. We're talking with Larry Tighe. His new book is Demagogue, the Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. He accomplished so much. He set his sights on goals and got there, but he wasn't well organized in his plans. You know, he'd have a goal and he'd just say to himself, all right, what do I need to do to get there? But it was pretty much on instinct, not a well thought out plan.
No, his instinct served him really well in terms of his ambition, but it was never a sense that I want this office so that I can do X, Y, and Z in terms of an agenda. And what he really wanted was a limelight, and he would do anything to get that limelight. And the first 3 or 4 years of his Senate term, the term that he was elected to in 1946, made him one of the least exceptional, one of the least paid any heed to people in the U.S. Senate, and it also made him look like a sitting duck for anybody who wanted to take him on and stop his bid for re-election. And that, rather than any sense of planning or any sense of having a clear vision for what he wanted to do as a senator, led him to the crusade for which his name became an ism. Hmm.
He was ruthless. Right. I mean, and he told so many lies. It's hard to imagine you could keep track of them all.
So that's true. And if I could take you for a second to a speech that he gave, the most important speech of his life, was a speech that he gave in 1950, in February of 1950, on the occasion of Abe Lincoln's birthday. And for Republicans, Lincoln Day celebrations were a way of raising money and raising the profile of whoever the speaker was. And Joe McCarthy was sufficiently low profile in 1950 as a U.S. senator that the speech that he was invited to give was in an out-of-the-way place in Wheeling, West Virginia. And he went that night to that speech with two potential texts in his briefcase. One was a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy, which was something he actually knew a little bit about, and the other was a barn burner of a speech charging that there were communist spies riddled throughout the government and especially in the U.S. State Department. Going there that night, he wasn't sure until the last second which speech he was going to give. And had he given the housing speech, you and I wouldn't be talking about him 70 years later. But instead he gave the barn burner of a speech, holding in his hand a bunch of papers and saying, I have here a list of 205 spies in the State Department. Now, in fact, he never showed anybody that list. And in fact, it wasn't the list of 200 spies in the State Department, but it was irresistible to journalists. Within a couple days, McCarthy was on the front page of every newspaper in America, and his crusade against communism that we ended up terming McCarthyism was born that night in the out-of-the-way place in Wheeling, West Virginia.
And not calculated, right? I mean, this is, again, just kind of going with his gut.
Was that he was looking for an issue that would give him a limelight, whether it was communism, whether it was housing, whether it was pork farming, whatever the issue was that would do it. The only element that really mattered was grabbing an issue and grabbing a spotlight.
Right. And he was a master manipulator of the media.
He knew just how the media worked. He knew that if he released his charges of communists in the State Department on an evening when people didn't have time in order to get it into the next morning's paper to check the facts and to go and talk to all the people that he was targeting, he knew that was a way to get his charges printed. And he knew the second day story, when you came back and you tried to be fair to people, nobody was going to pay attention to that, and that was unlikely to make page one. So he understood media deadlines, he understood how to manipulate them, and he understood that when the news was bad, you attack the newsman, and that could work as well as having a good story.
Yeah. Another interesting point that we forget is that there were no financial disclosure laws in the Congress in the 1940s.
So there weren't, and what that meant was that in the 40s and the early 50s, Joe McCarthy could get huge checks written to him by wealthy conservative businessmen in places like Texas. He did so much for the oil industry that they used to call him the third senator from Texas, and nobody could track that, and nobody was sure how much he gave. And it was only again three quarters of a century later, when we can see his personal and professional papers, that we can track the money, from whom he got it, and what he gave in return.
In 1947, President Truman launched a security screening measure called the Loyalty Order, and the AG's office to assist prepared this list of subversive organizations. And you write, while it painted with a broad brush groups supposedly sympathetic to communism, nobody explained why such sympathy was a threat when the Communist Party was legal. The ledger was then used by local and state officials, school boards, private employers, and more than anyone else, Joe McCarthy, to crush the groups and anybody who'd even been a member, no matter how young they were or how short their association. The slightest step out of line spelled doom. And we forget that, right? To be a communist organization was legal.
So it was legal, and the American Communist Party was never a real threat to anybody in America. The Soviet Union during the Cold War did pose a real threat, and the idea that there were spies for the Soviet Union in the U.S. government would have been something that was worth raising an alarm over. The problem was that by the time Joe McCarthy started raising his alarms, all the 24-carat spies were long gone, and the people that McCarthy was telling us were dangers were people who, during maybe their college years, they had a flirtation with left-wing politics and maybe even communism, or they had a brother or a sister or an uncle who was a Red. And the idea that these people were being cited as security threats to our country was absurd. And I think that lots of legitimate anti-communists from that era felt that their worst enemy was the leader of the crusade, Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at, you mentioned some of the organizations that the AG put on this list. It was 82 that grew to 299, included the Jewish Culture Society, the United Negro and Allied Veterans of America. I mean, agencies that you would think would never be on a list like this.
Yes, so my guess is that in today's world, if you applied those same standards, WCIA and anybody who would ever work for it would probably be on the list as well. It was anybody who was doing anything that challenged the status quo or sort of raised interesting issues. And I think that we could joke about it and say it would have been a badge of honor to be on McCarthy's hit list if it hadn't done such damage to the people who were on it, threatening, you know, not just their careers and their families, but sometimes involving their actual suicides because of it.
Yeah, and what evidence do we have of the suicides?
So the evidence we have is partly the testimony. I went back and tried to look at what had happened to as many of his high-profile victims as possible, and I found people like a guy named Reed Harris, who is a top official at an agency that's getting a lot of attention these days, at the Voice of America. And Reed Harris was the raked over the coals by Joe McCarthy for things that he had done when he was an undergraduate at Columbia University a generation before. He ended up losing his job, and the financial security of his family was thrown into disarray. And we see that a couple years after that, Reed Harris's wife just couldn't take it anymore, and she killed herself. And today, when I interview the son, he says the straight line from what Joe McCarthy did to what his mother did in response has been eating at this guy for half a century. And I saw that in case after case. The senator that McCarthy beat when he first ran for office, the iconic Republican senator from Wisconsin, Robert La Follette, ended up committing suicide years later, and because McCarthy was threatening to call him before a committee to explain some things that he had done when he was a senator, and La Follette's son, who went on to become Wisconsin's attorney general, says again the straight line from what Joe McCarthy did to his father's taking his life was one that, as a lawyer, he saw just there was no wiggle room there. It was a straight line. And I had enough of those people telling me that that at a certain point you started seeing a pattern, and it was an understandable one when you saw what McCarthy did to these people.
Yeah, he's thought of as, you know, this the father of the right wing, if you will, but he really started out his beginnings as a New Deal Democrat and then switched parties.
So in a way, Bobby Kennedy, who was the one who drew me into him, and Joe McCarthy were on opposite trajectories. Joe McCarthy started as a New Deal Democrat, as you say, an avid FDR supporter, but realized that in the part of Wisconsin he came from, he'd never win office as a Democrat. So after his first unsuccessful bid for office, he quietly changed parties and didn't just become a Republican. He became the leader of what was called the stalwart Republicans in Wisconsin, the most conservative wing of the Republican Party. So as he was moving from flaming liberal to right-wing icon, Bobby Kennedy, who went to work for him, started out as a Joe McCarthy cold warrior and ended up as a liberal icon. And at some point, their paths crossed, and at some point, McCarthy, as the opportunist he was, saw that whatever it took to get elected, the ideology didn't matter, the election results were what mattered.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the transcripts of McCarthy's closed-door hearings and both his personal and professional papers. Tell us a little bit about what those hearings looked like when nobody was looking.
So what they looked like was McCarthy used his closed-door hearings as a way of staging a tryout for what the witness would be like if he called them in public testimony. And any witness who could effectively rebut McCarthy's charges never showed up in public testimony. It was the weak and the most vulnerable that he used in his test runs to decide who to bring out in the public spotlight. Behind closed doors, we see that Joe McCarthy's use of terms like Fifth Amendment communist for anybody who tried to take their right against self-incrimination, McCarthy savaged them. We see essentially Joe McCarthy unhinged. We also see a very strange, but I think definable trend that in the mornings when Joe McCarthy went to the hearings and presided over them in a sober way, in a sober disposition, in not having had anything to drink, he was more sober-minded. And in the afternoon, after his two or three drink lunch, he became less patient, and it was hell to pay if you tried to contest him at all in the afternoon. So we actually saw a change in his disposition depending on the change of his inebriation level.
And we think about he never did find any real spies, did he?
So he never found spies that mattered. There was a list that came out eventually called the Venona Files that America, during the Cold War, had been decoding messages secretly from the Soviet Union and had really good lists of who the real spies were. And the overlap between McCarthy's list and the Venona list, while it did exist, it existed in a really small measure. That the idea of him finding any real spies almost seemed like an accident, because most of the people he was naming were not spies and were not risks.
Talk about Pearson, the announcer. Was it David or Dan Pearson? Drew Pearson, right?
Drew Pearson was the most read and the most listened to columnist in America. And while in the popular imagination, if people think of any journalist as having been responsible for bringing down Joe McCarthy, they think of Edward R. Murrow. A wonderful movie called Good Night and Good Luck was done on Murrow's the heroism in taking on the villain Joe McCarthy and bringing him down. The truth is that Edward R. Murrow himself said that he was late to that fight, and while he did some incredibly effective investigations of McCarthy, they were well into his crusade. The biggest hero in my mind was the much less popular and less heroic-looking Drew Pearson, who, at considerable risk to himself, took on Joe McCarthy at a very early stage and remained his number one antagonist in the press corps. And for his troubles, Pearson got raked over the coals by McCarthy in the U.S. Senate and got sort of beat up by him when they showed up one night at the same party together at a posh Washington nightclub.
And we have two versions of what happened that night.
We do. So we always, anything with Joe McCarthy, there are always two versions. But the version, much as it seems counterintuitive to say this, the version I trust the most was one by Richard Nixon, who was at that same party that night and tried to step between these two warring parties. And basically, Nixon's version had what I think really happened, which was that Joe McCarthy was the aggressor and that Drew Pearson either appeared like the Quaker pacifist that he was or like a coward, but whatever it was, he was the one who got beat up, and the one who did the beating was Joe McCarthy.
Let's talk about his wife, Jean, and their relationship. Because Joe was a bit, he was a womanizer, right?
So he was. He was a womanizer because I think that was his personality, and he never knew any limits on anything he did. He was a womanizer, I think, because he was trying to make a public point that he was not gay, and there had been charges as this bachelor senator from Wisconsin. The FBI and others investigated charges that he was gay. And he was, that was just his never knowing a limit. But finally, with Jean, a woman named Jean Kerr, who was, I think, smarter than Joe and was his biggest booster, after months of him being unwilling to make a commitment, they finally did get married. And she, to the end of his life, was the best thing that he had going.
Let's also talk a little bit about his relationship with Hoover.
So J. Edgar Hoover was brilliant at playing Joe McCarthy. Hoover understood that in his own battles against communists, he would look reasonable next to this raving, the crusader Joe McCarthy. He fed McCarthy information when that served his purpose, especially information attacking the administration of Truman, President Truman, who Hoover didn't like, and later with President Eisenhower. But Hoover knew enough that when Joe McCarthy started losing his popular support, Hoover withdrew his leaks and basically let McCarthy let him off on his own and stopped being his buddy. They used to go to the racetrack together. They used to have dinner together. But Hoover was out for Hoover. And in the end, when McCarthy became a threat, Hoover cut bait.
Interesting how many ex-FBI that Joe McCarthy would hire to work for him.
He did. So McCarthy knew that ex-FBI agents were his best way of trying to get leaks from the FBI and from other agencies. And Hoover, I think, knew that letting the best way to control Joe McCarthy was having his ex-agents be the people that McCarthy was relying on for his own staffing.
We're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Now, there's a really interesting connection here. McCarthy's chief counsel was Roy Cohn, who would later become counsel to Donald Trump.
Yes, so Roy Cohn was an incredibly smart, incredibly arrogant young lawyer from New York who Joe McCarthy hired when McCarthy became chairman of a very powerful subcommittee called the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. McCarthy needed somebody he could rely on. He also needed somebody to give him cover from charges, and I think quite legitimate charges, that he was an anti-Semite. So he hired a smart, young, Jewish, Democratic lawyer named Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn reinforced every bad instinct that McCarthy had in terms of being reckless in the charges that he raised. And Roy Cohn eventually became his undoing. But Roy Cohn was Joe McCarthy's protege, and half a century later, Roy Cohn was Donald Trump's mentor, and that is the flesh and blood through line from one demagogue to our current president.
Before I want to ask you about that, but before I say that, I want to go back to your book on Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby Kennedy was working for Joe McCarthy at the same time as Roy Cohn, and they did not get along.
So they didn't get along. The Cohn was convinced that Bobby Kennedy hated him because he was gay, hated him because he was Jewish, hated him maybe because he was from a certain kind of New York family that the that and the feelings were absolutely mutual. And in the end, it was Joe McCarthy having to pick between Roy Cohn and Bobby Kennedy as to who would become his top aide. And we can only imagine what McCarthy's history would have been like if he had picked Bobby Kennedy instead of Roy Cohn.
Yeah. So let's talk about the messages and strategies that Roy Cohn passes from McCarthy to Trump. Give us some concrete examples.
Sure. So I want to give you a sense of the one thing that Cohn taught Donald Trump was that when one reckless charge that you raise against somebody is disproven, instead of backing off or apologizing, you lob a fresh bombshell. He taught him that finding scapegoats was an easy way of answering people's legitimate fears. So whether it was an era of the Cold War when the scapegoat were American communists or liberals, or whether it was 2016 when the legitimate fear was people's economic security and the scapegoats became the immigrants who are trying to get into America, that you found a scapegoat, you developed charges against them, and you said they were responsible for everything. The scapegoat was also how you played the press and how you would attack the press when you didn't like what they were reporting. And the scapegoat was, before you let an enemy ever get the better of you, you kick them twice as hard, preemptively or after they've attacked you. And it was basically a playbook of ruthless tactics that McCarthy pioneered and that Trump has proven an able mentee.
Now, McCarthy went from a little-known senator from Wisconsin to the second most popular national figure in American politics in less than 3 years. Barely 6 months later, his poll numbers plummeted, and Congress punished him with a scathing report and a censure resolution. So what does this tell us about how the American public was taken in by him?
So it tells us a number of things. One, it says the public was taken in enough that the only politician in America more popular than Joe McCarthy at the start of 1954 was Dwight Eisenhower, the war hero president who had, despite his brother Milton Eisenhower whispering in his ear and telling him for a year and a half, take on that demagogue McCarthy, give up a bit of your popularity, Eisenhower never did that. At the start of 1954, McCarthy has fully one in every two Americans saying he's a great guy. By the end of 1954, his popularity went from 50% to barely a third, to about 34%. And that was because he had taken on an enemy too big to bully, and that was the U.S. Army. He charged that the Army was riddled with spies. It was charges that couldn't stand up. He had tried to get special treatment for Roy Cohn and Roy Cohn's sidekick, a guy named G. David Shine, a young aide who went into the military, and McCarthy tried to bribe, essentially, the Army into treating this guy, David Shine, nicely. When all of this came before the American public in these widely publicized hearings, the Army-McCarthy hearings, McCarthy, over time, started looking like a street bully rather than some towering hero. And so when an attorney from Boston named Joe Welch finally asked him in a dramatic moment, have you no shame, Senator, when he was attacking a young attorney, it was a moment that America started changing its mind on Joe McCarthy. And what it said to me is, no matter how popular somebody looks at a moment, when they're a bully and they suddenly start being perceived by a wider segment of the public as a bully, their numbers will fall, their enablers will disappear. People like Dwight Eisenhower and fellow senators came out of the woodwork and finally were willing to stand up to McCarthy, and they brought him down.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say there's more to the story than we thought with the Army, that both sides came out of these hearings smelling bad. So what new information is there on the Army's playing the same dirty pool that Joe did before and during the hearings?
So I mentioned that Joe McCarthy asked for special favors for his young aides, and the Army was all too willing to oblige. The Army was willing to suspend people that McCarthy targeted as spies and traitors when the evidence wasn't there that they were. And the Army was willing to play ball with McCarthy as long as McCarthy would go easy on them. And all of this came out in these hearings. And by the end, both sides looked horrible, but the Army had goodwill to fall back on. This was, after all, the U.S. mighty military machine that had won World War II, that was fighting a successful stalemate of a war in Korea, and it was, in the end, people were willing to cut the Army more slack, even though both sides came out pretty much devastated after those hearings.
Yeah. So he had a lot of enablers. Talk about the enablers and you know, why it took so long for them to, you know, why they enabled him for so long, I guess, is the question.
Sure. So one enabler we've talked about, and that was Dwight Eisenhower, who didn't want to take on the bully head on and wanted to wait until McCarthy took on an enemy he couldn't beat, like the Army. Another set of enablers were his fellow senators. The Democrats decided that they weren't about to sacrifice themselves to take on McCarthy, and they were waiting for McCarthy's Republican colleagues to confront him. And the Republicans, who had a very narrow majority in the Senate, weren't about to risk it with the public and risk giving up the seat from Wisconsin, so they were cowards. Another set of enablers were his wealthy benefactors in places like Texas. But in the end, the enabler that mattered the most was us. It was the public who bought into this bully for four long years.
Yeah. Now, McCarthy's wife, Jean, blamed Roy Cohn and David Shine for her husband's excesses. Is that fair?
So it was McCarthy who was the boss, and those were the young protégés. And while they reinforced his bad instincts, you got to blame the boss, not the staff.
Mm-hmm. What did your conversations with the victims and their descendants tell us that we didn't already know about the ongoing impact of McCarthyism?
So it told me that while those names were names that became famous for 15 minutes when Joe McCarthy targeted them, being targeted by him had a lifelong impact on those people and on their kids and even on their grandkids. And it was something that, to me, said something about who Joe McCarthy was. Joe McCarthy, after he would savage you on a witness stand, would often invite his targets out for a drink afterwards, and he assumed it was a game. And it was no game. And we really have to understand, because it's a lesson for today, that being victimized by a powerful politician, a bully politician, has a price that people are paying, and it's really tragic.
Talk a little bit about what happens to Jean and Tierney after Joe dies. Jean thought she might lose Tierney for a little bit there.
She did, because Joe and Jean had tried to have a baby on their own. They couldn't do it. They adopted. And they adopted in part by pulling strings with a very powerful Cardinal Spellman of New York, a guy who was referred to as the American Pope, pulled strings on Joe's behalf. He liked Joe's politics. They got Tierney adopted. And when Joe died, Jean was petrified that the adoption agency wasn't going to go through with the final stages of the adoption. Thankfully, again, with more strings pulled, they did. But it was going through life being Joe McCarthy's widow, or for a lot longer, being Joe McCarthy's daughter, was not an easy way to make your way through life.
Do you think maybe that's part of the reason she shared all this information with you?
So I'm not sure why she shared it. I think she may well have wanted the true story about her father, for better and for worse, to come out. I also think nobody really knew what was in those records. There were so many records, and they were left at a moment when Jean was still a suffering widow, and I think that she just decided to leave them all, and the only two people in the world who I think know everything that's in those records are the archivist who organized them and who thought that he was going to die before anybody else got to see them, and me, who went in and trying to make sense of them. And I think that the family really wasn't sure what was in there when they said yes.
So what are the lessons to be learned from Joe's story?
So the negative lesson is how vulnerable we are to be taken in by demagogues, and we've seen it throughout our history, and that we've got to learn from having done it once why we shouldn't do it again. The upbeat lesson is give a demagogue enough rope and they really will hang themselves.
And so what did you started the book with this being a book about our love affair with bullies. Did you come away with any more clarity on why?
So I came away with the idea that bullies are not dumb people who offer answers that don't have a chance of working, that we all want to be on the inside with the people who are strong and powerful and are willing to put on the outside people who are more easily scapegoated. And I think that our vulnerability to accepting simple answers and to accepting answers that are harsh on other people as long as they're not on us is a sad thing, and yet it's no different than people anywhere around the world. And I think the upside of the American story to this day is that we are quicker to see through bullies and to come out on the other end and to expose them. And hopefully all of our campaigns out there on a more personal level, anti-bullying campaigns, will someday translate into not accepting bullies in our public life either.
So what is the ultimate legacy of Joe McCarthy then? Do you think it ends in this mixed legacy and it's being more complicated figure than history generally records, or is that letting him off too easy?
So I think there's definitely more of a mixed legacy, and there's a reason he had charming and even charismatic aspects of his personality, and he told the truth about some things in his own life and in our world. But as much as there was evidence in these unseen files that redeemed parts of his personality and parts of his legacy, the fact is he was the archetypal bully in American history, and that, if there's any single thing we remember him for, has to be what his legacy is.
Biggest surprises in your research? I know one of the things I found reading the book, and I would highly recommend that people read the footnotes. There was so much interesting information in just the footnotes. I imagine you must have walked away from this with lots of surprises.
Lots of surprises, lots of sense. I used to say that if anybody ever writes a book over 500 pages, then they didn't have any willpower or they didn't have a good editor. And my book is over 600 pages, and things that in any other book that I was writing would have made it into the text had to make it into a footnote, because everything to me about this character and all these new revelations about him were so fascinating that I didn't find the discipline to cut it further and to weed out things from footnotes, because every aside, there was a surprise in every page. The love letters that Joe wrote to Jean and the eloquence of them and the humility of them belied the fact that this was America's number one bully. And this guy had so many parts to his personality and so dominated the American political scene for those 4 years that I just found myself perpetually intrigued.
Yeah, me too. Larry Tighe's new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry, as always, thanks for being with us. And we'll post more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.